Welcome to Worlds Apart. You are either with us or against us. For decades, this has been the chief principle of Western foreign policy, taken to its highest pitch with the start of Russia's operation in Ukraine. Due to its size and influence, India was among the most sought-after players, courted to join the proverbial right side of history, but it opted to chart its own course. Has it paid off? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Pankaj Saran, India's former Deputy National Security Advisor and former ambassador to Russia. Ambassador, it's a great honor, great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Now, you wrote recently that over the past year or so, India has gone from being a balancing world power to being a leading power. What's the difference?
I think there's a lot of difference. I think the balancing is a negative connotation. Leading is a positive connotation in the sense that it connotes greater self-confidence in the country, in your ability to take decisions on their merits and to advance your national interests, as well as to contribute to the global order in terms of its peace and stability. So I think we are at a transition phase in India. Largely also on account of much greater political stability in India. And there have been a few recent examples where we have been able to actually take positions which have been difficult, but which have resonated across the world. And, you know, so it's a whole package.
Well, let's try to unpack this package because, as you know, with great power comes great responsibility, including responsibility to inherit the world as it is with its countless troubles and the responsibility to offer solutions for crises of not your own making. What can India offer here?
If you go back to the past and where India is coming from, as a colony of the British for 200 years, we spent a long time trying to rediscover ourselves. And I think that moment has arrived. And today, we do not want to be on the coattails of any power or any side or any alliance. I think there is a desire in India to take these autonomous decisions. And that is basically driving the way we approach the world. And as you said, there are many things which we cannot control and may not be able to control because we are not yet a great power, unlike the established great powers. But we do feel that we can actually contribute, even if it's a little, to helping bring some issues to the fore, helping to reduce tensions, and helping to contribute to, let's say, the global commons.
I think we live in such an interesting moment when the influence of great powers is diminishing and sometimes consciously so. I think Russia it wants to project certain power, but it's very mindful about not projecting too much power because, again, it could be a liability. But we also see many regional powers, India including, coming to the fore and offering their own distinctive perspectives. What is so special about New Delhi's position? What can it offer to the world that nobody else can offer?
You know, firstly, today, we are the largest country in the world by population, 1.4 billion people. So what happens inside India and how India governs its own large population is a global good. Because if you can manage to improve the lives of such a large humanity, then you are contributing in a sense to the global good, number one. Number two, India is an old civilization, 5,000 years old. There was an interruption because of invasions, because of colonialism. But today there is that revival of that sense of Indian history where we say that we have solutions to global issues. We have our own path to pursue. Historically, India has never been a part of any military alliance or a political alliance. That is the fundamental difference between India and many of the other countries. So this comes with its own price because, as you said, there are alliances and countries which want you to be a part of them. And if you're not, then you're looked upon with suspicion. But India has kind of eschewed all these black and white divisions of the world. What India is saying is, we may be developing, but we are a democracy. So we have basically shown that you can be a democracy even if you're a poor country. That's the first thing. Secondly, the fact that you can balance your relationships, whether it's with the United States or with Europe or with Russia or with China till a few years ago, is also an evidence of how you are able to conduct these multidimensional relationships.
Now, you mentioned democracy, and it is such a loaded concept these days, because the West acts as if it has the sort of the full copyright to democratic ideas. And when you talk about democracy in India, there is something very practical and material in it, as if for you, democracy is something that has to be lived out rather than preached as a high concept, which is done by the West today. Can you talk more about this intersection of practicality or a sort of material democracy and how it translates into the actual lives of the people?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. You know, our version of democracy is very native. It's very Indian in the sense that it is rooted in our culture. It is essential to preserve the Indian Federation of 30 states, very different, diverse cultures, languages, ethnicities. So you need that framework where you can arrange peaceful transfer of power after every few years. Since 1947, so far in 75 years, except for a brief interregnum of 2-3 years, our record is that we've actually been able to hold these elections. We've been able to ensure peaceful transfer of power from one party to another, from one government to another, both in Delhi and in the states. And this requires a lot of maturity and a lot of conviction and commitment to the principles of democracy, because there is actually no other way in which India can live except through allowing its people to voice their views and opinions. And, you know, bring in governments, throw out governments. But we do not preach, we do not export democracy to other countries. What we tell them is, this is an example of a large country which is able to live like this, a very diverse country. And we think it's a great way to live.
Now, this system of governance and how it's applied in international decision-making, because in international decision-making, you also try to take into account various factors rather than pledging allegiance to just one. I think all of that was put to the test with the start of the Russian operation in Ukraine. And I know that you recognize that the conflict has been brewing for many years prior to that, but early last year, India was put under a lot of pressure to join the Western camp, and it didn't. Why it didn't?
Well, that, I would agree with you, was a very difficult time for Indian foreign policy. And we took a step back to try and understand what was the trigger to the conflict. That is how we approached our, how we formulated our policy. Yes, there was pressure to take a certain position, but we explained to everyone that we are not in favor of the conflict. We want a peaceful solution, but we also want that the security concerns and the, you know, a comprehensive approach to what led to the conflict is necessary, because at the end of the day, as far as we can understand it, sitting in New Delhi, Europe has to live at peace with itself. I mean, that actually was the whole outcome of the end of the Cold War and the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991.
I think taking that position that India took also required a degree of self-respect, believing that you yourself can make decisions about what's good and what's bad and how to balance all the negatives and all the positives. Do you think the choices that were made at that time in New Delhi, are they going to be contained to the Ukrainian crisis, or do you see them influencing the Indian stance internationally beyond what's happening in Ukraine? Do you think the consequence of the Ukrainian decision-making will be more lasting than the conflict itself?
No, you know, the approach that India took is actually, funnily enough, consistent with the kind of approach India has taken since 1947. I mean, if you remember, during the Cold War, India refused to be a part of any alliance. And of course, it was not popular with either of the two sides. So if we could do that at that time in the first Cold War, this time around, it was easier because India is slightly more, has greater capacity. It's a richer country, relatively speaking. It has more capability, more experience about international politics. At that time, we were young, just newly independent. So it was easier this time. But yes, the consequences will go beyond Ukraine. I mean, in the sense that they constitute a certain approach to the international balance of power, which is unique, which great powers are not familiar with, because as I said, they like to see the world in blocks and camps. India does not. And this position that India took on Ukraine will actually constitute the kind of positions India will take on many, many issues. It's not a question of trying to balance anything. It's a question of taking decisions which are in your self-interest, which advance India's national interests, but also contribute to global peace and stability. So it's a mix of both. And this is not an easy path to choose, because the easier path is to say, okay, you know, I'll adopt, I'll, you know, be on one corner of the room and the other corner.
But Ambassador, you say that it wasn't easy, but at the same time, the opposite decision would have come with certain costs, and continuing your partnership with Russia afforded India a lot of economic opportunities. I mean, you're receiving Russian oil and gas at affordable prices. It allows your industry to grow. And for some reason, in current geopolitics, it's somehow shameful to, you know, think about your own immediate concerns. Do you think that perhaps India can also show an example to other nations that it's actually okay to mind your own national interest in a comprehensive way? That doesn't mean that you are selling out your, I don't know, your collective soul to the devil, that it's actually prudent to be mindful of how your own people live and also, you know, looking at the broad picture internationally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone is doing it. In fact, all major powers and great powers are looking at their national interests. I mean, the United States...
Well, the United States says that they are the defenders of humanity as such, that they are actually protecting universal interests in Ukraine.
Well, they withdrew from Afghanistan. That was largely on account of their domestic pressures. It was a consequence of their own national interest, the way they perceived it. So every country is doing is actually pursuing policies which are relatable to your national interests. So you mentioned on the question of oil. Yes, a lot of questions were asked from India by Western strategic experts, Western governments. And we told them that we are not telling anyone to buy Russian oil. We are telling people to buy the cheapest oil. And if that happens to be Russian, that's fine, because the companies are taking commercial decisions. And after all, for 50 years, the Europeans were doing the same thing. So it's not as if India was being opportunistic. India was just, you know, playing the market. And Indian companies were sourcing. And of course, we need cheap energy, because 85% of our energy is imported.
Okay. Well, I have to be opportunistic. I see nothing wrong with that. At the moment, we have to take a short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Pankaj Saran, India's former Deputy National Security Advisor and former Ambassador to Russia. Ambassador, before the break, we were talking about the Ukrainian crisis, and I want to delve into its origins a little bit, because you wrote that for those following the shadow boxing between the West and Russia since the mid-2000s, the conflict in Ukraine was a textbook example of war being the pursuit of political objectives by other means. First of all, I want to ask you, why do you think the boxing went on in the shadows for so long, for several decades, and why do you think it burst into the open?
Yeah, you know, I've thought a lot about this. And, you know, the fact is that I think if you trace the events back to, let us say, even President Putin's speech at the Munich Security Conference in 2007, in the context of NATO expansionism to the East, I think at that time he, because from 2000, the first few years of his presidency was a time when Russia became a member of the G7. There was good engagement. It was a dialogue partner with NATO. Things were going well. The world was at peace. We saw the fruits of the collapse of the Soviet Union, or let's say the end of the Cold War, in front of us. But in those initial years, we also saw NATO expansionism taking place and the Russian leadership trying to convey to the Europeans and the Americans that, look, this is a problem for us because it is going to complicate Russia's security environment. And I think that from then till the events in Ukraine in 2013-14 and the Maidan and everything else, that actually seems to have been, let us say, the thin end of the wedge. And from then onwards, from 2014, you know, you had all the agreements, the Minsk Accords and everything else. Nothing really worked.
You've also argued that the conflict in Ukraine has once again posed the question of whether the East and the West can coexist. The question we thought was solved at the end of the Cold War. And you also wrote that the contradictions we believed had been settled by the end of the Cold War have resurfaced once again. Are you sure that they are the same old contradictions? Because at the end of the Cold War, during the Cold War, the West was very careful about not expanding its military infrastructure to the East. There was very icy cold, but stringent etiquette between the adversaries on how to deal with one another and how not to create dangerous, provocative situations for one another. All of that seems to have changed. Are we really dealing with the old contradictions, old grievances, or totally new ones?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. But I think in this time around, the instruments or the tools of policy are different in the sense that they're not the classical, it's not ideological, firstly. It's not a traditional military war or conflict at that time. It was a more of a hybrid nature of contestation and mutual suspicion. And all of this actually made the whole issue much more complex, as you're suggesting, and different from the first Cold War, because that was more organized, if one can use that word. This was more unpredictable, more subterranean. It wasn't really in evidence. And this kind of, you know, went from one stage to another. We found political inability to find solutions. And the whole thing seemed to come to rest with Ukraine, not any other part of, let's say, the Russian border. Of course, we had Georgia and other...
But they were all premised on the same sort of thing that the West assumes the power to control or impose its own solutions, regardless of the you know, situation on the ground or what the adversaries of the West are thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's. I think it's a failure of the European security architecture. I mean, some people argue that there actually was no architecture at that time, but I think there was a certain form and a certain consensus on how the East and West can live together. I mean, there was a lot of integration happening between Russia and Europe, whether it was energy or trade or investment. you know, things were happening which everyone wanted to see and everyone was happy with.
Can I ask about this? Because as I was preparing for this interview, this comparison between India and Europe, I found it very curious because, like India, Europe has enjoyed decades of reliable and beneficial trade with Russia. Europe has a major stake in preserving security on the continent. And yet, with the both prior to the breakout of violence in Ukraine and since that, it has taken a very passive position. It ceded all the decision-making to Washington. How do you explain it? Why do you think Europe's position wasn't more like India's, you know, minding, you know, finding its own third way, not necessarily joining with Russia, but finding its own middle ground? Instead, Europe seemed to have just evaporated from the scene.
You know, Europe is living in different sub-regions of Europe. I mean, initially, my impression is that the old Europe, so-called, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Netherlands, I mean, they actually were in the forefront of European security, European foreign policy. But in the last few years, we found, let's say, the Baltics, Eastern Europeans, Poland, and some other countries, which have become much more assertive. And so within Europe, I think there are differences on what European policy towards Russia or even China should be. The Transatlantic Alliance actually had become more relaxed. If you remember, during President Trump's time, he basically told the Europeans, you have to pitch in more, you have to raise your defense budget, you have to take care of yourselves. But I think over the last few years, and France and Germany actually were the co-guarantors, in a sense, of the Minsk agreements and the Minsk Accords, and they actually played a key role. There was good communication between the leaderships of those countries with the Russian leadership.
Absolutely, but it was only communication. It wasn't translated into the actual policy. I mean, when they came a test of putting those agreements into practice, again, it was not worth the paper that it was.
Yeah, so it was, as I said, a diplomatic failure. It was a failure of political will. And it was all heading in the wrong direction. And that's what happened last year when you went from this kind of a hidden conflict, contestation, to an open traditional conflict. And Europe was more relaxed in the sense that, you know, that their defense budgets were low. They were not really putting in that much money into their defense structures or institutions. So all this has changed. Now, I mean, I would say both sides have become more militarized. And the NATO Transatlantic Alliance, despite all the internal differences, is more robust. Yet there are voices in Europe today which do not see eye to eye with the Washington on how to live with Russia and how to reorder the European architecture.
As I'm sure you know, at the beginning of this conflict, the Indian Foreign Minister Jaishankar made headlines. When he was pressed on India's stance on the Ukrainian conflict, he said that Europe has to grow out of the mindset that Europe's problems are the world's problems, yeah, and the world's problems are not Europe's problems. How much time do you give to Europe to realize that it actually has problems? Because up until this point, they seem to be under the impression that they're in this big fight against the archetypal evil. But when do you think this practicality of reality, you know, the shortage of money, the shortage of resources, the shortened ability to develop their own industry, when do you think it will dawn on the Europeans to change the course of action and to make them more rooted in their own interests?
You know what? I unfortunately am not very optimistic because I think views have hardened on both sides. I think there is probably, it's true to say, a certain degree of collapse of dialogue that is happening. Europe is also suffering badly, as you said, because of energy inflation, almost low or zero growth, much less consumption, consumer demand, and social problems related to migration from Ukraine, from Africa. So they are facing multiple challenges. How long they will take, I really don't know. I hope Europe can accept the fact that there is no other way except to find some modus vivendi with Russia. And similarly, Russia also has to step out and make moves because, you know, look, the whole world is watching what's going on. And the whole world is also suffering and getting impacted, whether it's food, energy, fertilizer, anything else. So the stakes are high. At the moment today, there is not much cause for optimism because I think the mood is not good. But we can just hope and keep our fingers crossed that, the battlefield conditions wind down, that we return to the dialogue table, and both sides show some degree of political will to find a solution.
Can I ask you, as somebody who knows this country very well, and I want to be fair to the receiving side as well, because you've written that Moscow is unlikely to give back the territories that it has seized by now, but how far do you think it would be willing to go, and how far it's wise to go? Because it's pretty obvious that part of Ukraine forever will remain hostile to Russia. So in this very delicate balance between, let's say, political objectives and political responsibility, where would you draw the line? As somebody who knows this country well.
Yeah, there's been a lot of loss of life, loss of infrastructure on both sides. A lot of blood has been spilt. I mean, for what? I mean, the question is, at the end of the day, I don't see a situation where Russia will withdraw and, somehow say goodbye to all the kind of advances and they have made. But when you sit on the table and negotiate with your adversary or with the other side, both sides have to compromise. And if you want a solution, now this business of territory is one issue. The question of guarantees, ensuring the security of the other and getting back to peaceful coexistence is another issue. How much of territory are you going to trade for peace? There are demands on both sides, which are obviously maximalist. I mean, the Ukraine and the Europeans and NATO says not an inch of Ukraine. The Russians are saying, look, we have serious concerns. So I see a difficult negotiation ahead, some kind of an armistice or a pact. But it'll be a difficult circle to square. It will challenge traditional notions of sovereignty, of territorial integrity, of the rule of law. I don't know how it's going to happen. It's not going to be easy. But unless you either freeze the conflict or you continue this for several years in a kind of a low-grade situation, I don't know which way it will go.
Well, Ambassador, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Wonderful. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.